and welcome to the Undisclosed Podcast. This is one of your hosts, Colin Miller. As always, I am joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm well. Thanks, Colin. How are you?
Doing great, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Maggie Rooley. She is a London-based ABC News correspondent who spends her life covering stories all around the world. She is also the host of the truly terrific podcast, The Snare. It is a six-part podcast series from 2020 on ABC Audio. It investigates the 1996 murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge in Idaho Falls, as well as her mother's decades-long fight for the truth, along with the unlikeliest of partners. And so, Maggie, welcome to the podcast.
Guys, thanks so much for having me on. And thank you for calling it terrific. This was truly a labor of love by many people to bring this story back to life. And as you mentioned, some of the characters involved, there's, you know, a mother's love and justice and a decades-long saga. There's really so much to the story.
Yeah, and this is your first foray into the true crime world. As I said, you mostly are covering stories around the world. I know ABC had the interrogation tapes and did an episode in this case. Is that how you learned about it, or how did you learn about this case?
Yeah, exactly. 2020 had done an episode. The interrogation tapes was another episode. Historically, ABC had a ton of amazing reporting on this case. And I think what's so fascinating is, you know, this is a case that's more than 20 years old, yet it is still so relevant today. And the people involved in it are still dealing with the aftermath today, which I think, you know, you mentioned it's my first sort of foray into true crime. And something that really struck me about getting involved in true crime is just that how there's the headline, right? The headline that grips people. But then every story has these tentacles. And it's sad and heartbreaking and, you know, amazing to see how a story, one crime, can impact so many people in so many different ways. And this story really, really amplifies that.
Maggie, I have a question for you. Is this also like your first audio production, your first podcast of sorts?
It is. This was my very first podcast. Okay. Thanks for welcoming me to the community.
Welcome. And you will never escape now. This is how it is. You
always think it's the one. I am hooked.
If we can orient our listeners, so we have this young woman, Angie Dodge. She has just moved out of the family home. And what can you tell us about Angie and what was going on for her in 1996?
Yeah, you know, Angie was just 18 years old. And you read about her. She really was one of those young women that I was just starting off, right? She had just moved into her first apartment all by herself. It's sort of described as a place that for many people would look like not much, sort of on the dodgy side of town. But for her, it was everything, right? Do you remember back when you're 18 and you get that sort of first slice of independence? And, you know, even if you're living in a shoebox, it feels like a mansion because it's yours finally. And that's where she was. She was working multiple jobs, one at a beauty counter. You know, everyone said she was quite a beautiful young woman, had a great group of friends, came from a tiny town in Idaho where everyone sort of knew each other. And she was really just starting. I think that's what struck me the most. It's just you got this sense that there was so much potential there and so much life that she planned to live.
And where is she working and what are her career goals and aspirations at the time this all goes down?
Yeah, you know, it seemed like she was still really figuring it out. She had a couple jobs, one at a beauty counter in town. She was still sort of hanging out with her local community friends, but she finally had gotten that first apartment. She was so proud of it. It was all that she could afford, but it was hers. And I think she was still trying to figure out what life was going to be for her, probably as we all are at 18 and maybe all still are at, you know, almost 40. But for her, she kind of had her whole life ahead of her.
And then one morning at this job at the beauty parlor, she doesn't show up.
Yeah.
And that leads to this chain of events where what happens after that?
Yeah, so it was two of her colleagues that noticed she just didn't show up for work one morning, and it wasn't like her. So they went around to her apartment. They went into her apartment, and, you know, they quickly called the cops, and a quite grisly scene was discovered, to say the least. We go into it in quite detail in the podcast, and I have to say, reading those words was so hard. Sometimes just the simplest descriptions say so much. You know, they found Angie. Her pants were around her ankles. There was evidence that she had been assaulted and raped. There was cuts across her body, one deadly wound that ultimately took her life. And, you know, the details of just how her room was still filled with so much innocence. She was still moving in. She still had sort of her kid belongings with her in this room. You know, at 18, you're an adult, but barely. And that was also evident in this crime scene. You know, the artwork for the podcast, I think, is so just gut-wrenching, because at the crime scene, and what we show on the artwork is a teddy bear with blood on it.
I was thinking of the same thing because at 18, you know, that's when a lot of kids are moving into their college dorms. And they'll and especially girls will take that stuff. They'll take their little teddy bears and their little these kinds of things. So, you know, it sounds like a crime scene that would have plenty of forensic evidence. And I, when I first look at this, I assumed that it was forensic evidence and led police to the initial suspect, who was Benjamin Hobbs. But so can you explain how they got to Hobbs, though? Because I don't think it was a forensics.
Exactly. And there was plenty of forensics. You know, there was DNA all over this crime scene, but police could never match it. They had the DNA. They took DNA tests from multiple friends and family, people in the neighborhood. Over 100 DNA tests were taken. There were just no matches. So imagine how frustrating that is for police officers on this case, thinking they have, you know, gold. They have the DNA of people that were at this crime scene, and they just simply cannot match it. But they started doing interviews with close family, friends. She had a really good group of friends in town. They were known as the River Rats. They would hang out by the Idaho River. And it was one of those acquaintances in her group who was later arrested, not in Idaho, but nearby, for a separate crime that seemed similar. It was, you know, another attempted rape at knife point. So police started questioning this friend group, trying to uncover, well, if this one person, you know, was accused of this crime that seems so similar, perhaps they were also guilty in Angie Dodge's case. So they started bringing in the friend group and questioning people. And that's how Ben Hobbs got brought in. That's how Chris Tapp got brought in. These were all friends, close friends of Angie that knew her, that had seen her down by the river.
Hobbs and Chris Tapp, they actually knew Angie. I thought they were friends together, but not friends with Angie.
They knew Angie. Yes, they said they had saw her even earlier that night from when the murder took place. They had claimed to have seen her down by the river and were all in the same group of friends. You know, it's a little unclear how close they all were, but they all hung out together. The town was quite small. Everyone sort of knew each other. And so they definitely were all in the same friend group. And that's how police ultimately came to question Ben and then also Chris, who was friends with Ben.
And how... we hear this in the podcast, someone, and it's important for what ultimately happens. How would you describe Chris's personality and demeanor?
Oh, you know, this is such a fascinating character. And in many ways, the second tragedy of this case is Chris Tapp. And you start to hear from him. You know, we have hours and hours of interrogation tapes of the police with Chris Tapp, of polygraphs chats with Chris Tapp. And, you know, later in the podcast, which was incredible, we hear from Chris himself talking about this time. And he says he really just wanted to help the police. And that's kind of what you hear in the beginning of these tapes. Police are asking him questions. You know, how well did you know Angie? What were her friends like? Was Ben involved? Were other people involved? They start naming names in their friend group. And Chris had said that in hindsight, he genuinely was trying to help. He was a people pleaser. He wanted them to like him. He wanted to be able to give them answers. And that's how he kept getting asked back. You know, you listen to interrogation tapes from some of the other people involved in this crime. They just shut it down. They say it wasn't me. And then they kind of stopped talking and they ultimately got released because there was no evidence and it wasn't them. Chris Tapp keeps talking.
Yeah, how old was Chris at the time?
Yeah, he himself was also young, 20 years old, also, you know, an adult, but barely.
Right.
And you hear that in his voice during these tapes as well. You know, while in many ways he was an adult in society, again, you know, part of the town, he had graduated from high school, you know, he was very much into adulthood. At 20, you're still pretty young, right? You're still making decisions that aren't the best for you, I think we can all say in hindsight. And so police take him into these interrogation rooms. As we mentioned, they gave him multiple polygraph tests. You know, in total, he's in there for around 60 hours of interrogation and polygraph.
60.
Yeah, 60.
And 16. 16 is, the studies show, 84% of false confessions come after 16 hours of interrogation. And Maggie, as you said, it's 60 hours, right, that he's interrogated.
That's wild.
When I hit my mid-30s, I started noticing that my workouts weren't as easy as they used to be. And over the next decade and a half, the harder it hit me. Same workouts, same swim, same diet, but everything felt tougher, including my recoveries. One day I'm going all out in a swim, and the next, everything feels twice as hard. And that's because most men start losing testosterone at around age 30, and about 1% every year after that. That's why I started taking Mars Men. Here's why. Your body makes testosterone, but a lot of it gets locked up and can't be used. There's this protein called SHBG that basically handcuffs your testosterone. And so, even though your body's making testosterone, SHBG locks it up so you can't access it. It's like having money in the bank, but no ability to withdraw it. Mars Men is designed to help free lock testosterone so your body can actually utilize it. There are no synthetics, no needles, just real ingredients that help optimize energy, focus, and strength, like vitamin D, zinc, and boron. As a result, it's not like drinking a cup of coffee, it's a steadier sense of drive throughout the day. Mars Men is made in the USA, third-party tested, and now available at GNC nationwide. And they offer a 90-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. Worst case, you don't absolutely love it, and you get your money back. But over 91% of users report higher energy levels. For a limited time, our listeners get 50% off for life, plus free shipping and 3 free gifts at mengotomars.com. That's mengotomars.com for 50% off and 3 free gifts when you check out. After a purchase, they will ask you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them our show sent you. And he's given multiple polygraphs. And listeners always ask, you know, why do you talk about polygraphs on the podcast? They're not admissible. But Maggie, my understanding from reading some about the cases is that Chris actually came to believe the polygraph could read his subconscious. Is that something you came across in the case?
Yeah, Chris talks about this, how, you know, when the police would talk to him about these polygraph caves, he really took them as almost gospel. And the police would tell him, you know, the polygraph is saying that you're lying, and perhaps you don't know that you're lying. Perhaps something so traumatic happened that you sort of block this out, and it's your subconscious now trying to tell the truth. And you can hear Chris almost get confused in the tapes. I think that's what's so shocking to me. We you know, have access to so much of these tapes. We play a lot of these tapes, and you're just listening to the audio, and you hear this young man get confused and start saying things. And, you know, I think for me, what is so shocking is I think all of us, for the most part, hear that someone gives a confession and you think, well, they're guilty. Who would ever give a confession if you didn't do it, right? Think about it. Like, would you ever confess to something that you didn't do, let alone a horrific rape and murder? No, of course not. You would never confess to that. That seems absurd. And you hear things like false confessions and you genuinely cannot understand how they happen. And what's so fascinating about this podcast is that it breaks down the tapes and the process, and you hear the slow drip of how it happens. And by the end of it, you start to get it. You start to see how people really do falsely confess to a crime they never committed.
Yeah, in 1997, look, I mean, in 1997, we did not know then what we know now about polygraphs. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as widely known that, you know, polygraphs, what they actually measure, what they don't measure, why they are not actually reliable. And the idea of like that anybody who falsely confesses, if you ask me, and I've been an attorney for 25 years, but I've been working in this field for a decade. If you asked me 10, 15 years ago, would I falsely confess, or can people fall? I wouldn't have even believed it. This is relatively new in the public discourse and people understanding broadly that these things happen and how they can happen. So I can completely see this kid in 1997, like really believing this whole thing about like the polygraphs are picking up something in my mind I don't even remember. I can totally believe that.
Yeah. And Maggie, right? My understanding is at the start of this process, the officers tell Chris, we have irrefutable evidence that it was Ben who committed this murder and you were there. Is that kind of how this whole interrogation process starts?
Yeah, exactly. Initially, they're sort of questioning him as a friend, someone who may have been involved. And that's what's interesting as well, is you see this process of, you know, even during his so-called confession, it becomes worse and worse. Initially, he just, you know, Ben told him that he did it. And then the next step was that he was there with Ben. And the next step, he, you know, held her down. And then it was he participated. And you see this evolution of him involving himself more and more in this crime. And again, you know, it's almost hard to wrap your mind around how this is happening. Why is he saying all these things that he know didn't happen? But right. you start to feel sort of the panic that Chris feels when you listen to these tapes and hear it in his voice. And he's just desperate to kind of get out of that room and give them whatever they need.
The problem is, though, that these confessions fly in the face of like early DNA testing, right? Can you explain how that what happened there?
So this is what's fascinating, right? So they have this confession, but as we already mentioned, they have DNA from the crime scene, right? They know this DNA was somehow involved in the rape and murder of Angie Dodge. They test both Ben and Chris's DNA, and both of them are not matches. So you have this man, Chris, who has confessed to this horrific crime, but his DNA doesn't match the crime scene. It can't be found anywhere there. And so you're kind of left with this huge question mark, even with this confession. One, how is it true, right? Like, he's confessed to things where his DNA should be all over the place, but it's not there. And then secondly, if his confession is true somehow, clearly someone else was still involved. They have this missing DNA of someone right. who definitely was involved in the rape and murder.
And Maggie, beyond that, and I just was talking to a student yesterday, she's doing a research project on why all custodial interrogation should be recorded. Mm-hmm. And in this case, as you say, we have recordings of yeah. what happened with Chris Tapp. And it's not just people like you and us who can watch these, but in this case, we have the mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Watching these yeah. recordings. And what does she see as she is watching these 60 hours of interrogation of Chris Tapp?
This, for me, I think, is the heart of this entire case. You have Carol Dodge, Angie's mother, who, you know, obviously her world is turned upside down, gut-wrenching, heartbreaking, all of the things to describe what she feels with the death of her only daughter at 18. And initially, you know, after the confession, Chris Tapp is convicted, and she is there demanding the death penalty, right? She wants justice for her daughter. But she also realizes, while she believes at that point that Chris Tapp was guilty and she wants him to face the death penalty, that someone else is also guilty out there, that police haven't finished this job. And so it's really, you know, Carol, as well as some other police officers, but Carol at the heart of this, that just does not quit. I cannot stress that. And this woman is ferocious mm-hmm. and incredible and exhaustive and doesn't quit. She spends week after week, you know, it's described as she goes to the tough areas of town, the dangerous areas. She's questioning people. She's showing up at the police station at least once a week, giving them what she knows, demanding they tell her what they know. She will not let this case go away because she knows there's someone else out there that's involved in the murder of her daughter. There's DNA and she's going to find it. So finally, years later, you know, she does the very difficult task of sitting down to watch these 60 hours. And initially she does it because she's trying to figure out what did police miss, right?
Right.
Chris is guilty. What did he know? I'm going to watch these 60 hours closely and figure out what police missed.
Was this after Chris is actually convicted of this?
Yeah, Chris has been convicted. He's okay. been in jail for years. And she finally sits down to watch these interrogation tapes. And it's then at the end of this, she has this realization. She goes, Chris is innocent. This is not the man.
It's devastating, yeah.
And he doesn't know the crime, this grotesque crime scene. He doesn't know key details. He really should.
Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't know key details from the crime scene. When you listen to the tapes, he sometimes, it appears almost, you know, led to this information that he then repeats. And Carol calls all of this out. And it's actually Carol that calls the attorney working with Chris Tapp. You know, the attorney says, never in my wildest dreams did I imagine the mother of the victim that, you know, my client is convicted of murdering would call me and say, let me help you. Let me get this man out of jail.
Maggie, I have a question. Right. So at this point, Chris has been convicted, but they have DNA from the crime scene that does not match Chris. Is there a co-defendant also convicted? Did they match it? What happened to that?
No, and that's the part that was always lingering for police. It's why this case sort of kept going and going. And it's why Carol was so determined to find the other person involved in this crime because, you know, she knew someone else was out there. It wasn't just Chris Tapp. There was someone else involved in this. And then after watching those tapes, she realized, oh, it's not just someone else. It's maybe the only person. Chris Tapp is innocent. He had nothing to do with this. You know, these tapes for her showed that his confession was false. And this was something that Chris had been battling for many years while sitting in prison. He had had an attorney working with him. He had had many appeals, all of them shot down. And it wasn't until Carol got involved and got the Innocence Project involved that there was really any traction on this case. You know, and then she became the one, arguably his biggest advocate.
Wow.
And just imagine that, right? You have the mother of this young woman fighting for the man convicted of raping and murdering her. I mean, this is a incredible partnership.
It's definitely a bad look for the state, I'll have to say.
Yeah.
A question about Chris's confession. Did he recant this confession at any point?
Yes, he had said that it was not a true confession, but the jury had already heard it and they had already decided that, you know, they believed it was a true confession.
Got
and
it.
So even though he did take it back, it was, you know.
And he had an alibi, apparently, for that evening.
And, you know, I think part of the problem was his story often changed when you listen to the tapes.
Right, right.
It's constantly changing. And so I understand. And it's really important to point out as we're talking about these tapes that the police have stood by their interrogation tactics. And at the time, as you mentioned, things have changed so much and we've learned so much.
Right.
And at the time, they were using interrogation tactics that were widely used. And they didn't believe they were doing anything wrong. They were trying to solve this murder that had gripped this small town, rocked this small town. They had so much pressure on them. They wanted to find whoever was responsible for this horrific crime, and they really believed they were doing what was right. And now we can look back on it, you know, with 2020 glasses, realizing that a lot of these tactics have now changed many decades on. But at the time, you know, they stand by what they did.
My daughter goes off to college this week, and as much as I hate to let her go, I have promised her that I'm going to help her make her dorm room look exactly the way she wants, just like on her Pinterest board, because we have been shopping from Wayfair. Almost everything that is furnishing her college dorm is coming from Wayfair, from her curtains, to her bedding, to the decorative pillows, to the rug, storage units, all of it. That's because I know that items from Wayfair are made with quality materials that stand up to real life. I have been shopping from Wayfair for years. I think half the furniture in my house, definitely all of my outdoor furniture, has come from Wayfair. Wayfair has decor and furniture that is built to last. And you can shop, by the way, with Wayfair Verified. That is a shortcut to durable pieces that are hand-vetted by product specialists using a 10-point quality inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. One of my favorite features on Wayfair is looking at all the great feedback from customers. Like, if you click on the ratings, you can look at pictures, you can see how it's going to look in your room. It really gives you a sense of the quality and durability of the product and even the aesthetics of it, you know, how people thought it looked like in their space, if the color was true to what was online and all those things. And if you're a Wayfair reward member, you get 5% back, helping you get even more value from your Wayfair purchases. You can create a home that you love without overspending or create a dorm that your kids will love without overspending because they have a wide range of prices to help find what fits your budget and what's right for you. Wayfair has more than 20 million verified 5-star reviews from real shoppers, including me. So join Wayfair Rewards today to get 5% back on every purchase and start saving on your next home upgrade. Head to wayfair.com and shop all things home. That's wayfair.com, W-A-Y-F-A-I-R.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Maggie, in terms of Carol having this itch she needed to scratch and feel like she was missing a piece of the puzzle, you report on this really extraordinary clue that is, I think, still unanswered, which is, I think, soon before Angie is killed, she has a conversation with her mom. And I think she says something along the lines of she did something stupid. And that's sort of this, we're not sure what that was that she was telling to her mom, right?
And this haunted her mother, as you can imagine. You know, her mom has said that her and Angie got into a huge fight when she moved out and they weren't talking.
Oh.
So imagine that. You know, you're not talking to your 18-year-old daughter. And she,
that's awful.
She tears up when she talks about this. And she's so grateful for the fact that, you know, right before the murder happened, Angie came to see her mom. And they had this moment where they reconciled and they made up and they were mother and daughter again. And Angie confided in her mom, you know, mom, I did something really stupid. And Carol has since said she regrets not finding out what that was. And it's haunted her for decades, right? Thinking, was that stupid thing somehow involved in my daughter's murder? Had I just maybe asked a question or figured out what it was, could I have changed the course of this? Mm. And it was part of the driving force for Carol as well to find out what happened, what really happened to her daughter. For Carol, I think it took over her life. She talks about not getting to know her grandchildren because she was so focused on finding her daughter's murderer, and that she really spent, you know, two decades, 20 plus years dedicating every sort of moment of her life, every thought she had to finding her daughter's killer.
Right. And part of that quest is to turn to genealogy databases. Yeah. In Idaho at the time, doesn't allow for searches of these private databases. We have Ancestry.com. And so, Maggie, what eventually happens in this search for a DNA match?
Yeah, so this is where the story just keeps getting more incredible. So eventually, we should note that Chris Tapp was released from prison. His crime was lessened. He was released from prison, but at that point, they couldn't prove that he was fully innocent. So he still had this murder charge hanging over his head, but he was released. And, you know, there's this incredible scene that we paint a picture of where you have Chris Tapp released from prison and who's standing by his side, but Carol Dodge holding his hand. He had, you know, Carol and her family wearing T-shirts that supported him, standing by his side for this moment of his release. And just this incredible partnership that the two of them formed, perhaps the most unlikely partnership you could ever imagine, to get him out of jail. So once he was freed, the story's not over because we still don't have the killer. Carol has not stopped working. And she's the one that brings, at the time, what is very new research that's being developed around genealogy testing. And she starts to work with some research firms that have done this in the past. The investigation is reopened at the county level, and they start investigating Angie's murder. And so they tap into genealogy. And to your point, they use ancestry databases. They use the DNA. They find a familial tree. There's no exact matches, but there's sort of some, you know, vague connections here and there. Police comb through the database, and they're able to eventually, down the road, find a person of interest who matches a man who happened to be living in the neighborhood where Angie Dodge lived at the time of Angie's murder. So all of a sudden, they think, okay, wow, we have what we believe to be a potential link in DNA to this man. And he was in the vicinity of Angie. They go and check. His DNA has never been tested. He was questioned in Angie's murder, but his DNA was never taken. So there's this huge hole, and you can hear from the police in this moment, they're almost giddy with anticipation. They think, is this our man? Finally, after all of these years, could this be him? And then what happens is this, you know, incredible detective work, a stakeout, an old school stakeout where you know, they describe driving to his apartment. They follow him day after day. They get his routine. There's this one scene where he flicks a cigarette out the window, which they describe as, you know, a DNA bomb. If you get the cigarette, you can get the DNA. And they're trying to run across a highway to get the cigarette, and they can't get it in time, and they've missed it. But they don't give up. They keep following him. And finally, police go in and are able to collect one of those cigarettes and take him in for questioning. And at the time, they've matched the DNA on that cigarette to the DNA from Angie's apartment. Wow. So they know that this man they picked up matches the DNA of Angie's apartment. But police say, you know, we're not messing this one up. We are going to interrogate this man by the book. We are going to also get a confession from him and to figure out why this crime happened and to make sure that there are no lingering questions. So then they have the DNA match. They bring this man in to be questioned. And over the course of this questioning, you slowly see him breaking down. He's an older man at this point, you know, just slightly in his middle age, past middle age. They describe him as having back issues. They describe him as sort of needing help to get comfortable in the chair. And as they're questioning him, you see him slowly break down until finally police leave him alone for a second. And they describe this moment of him, you know, almost holding his hands in his head, almost vomiting in that interrogation room. Wow. And then when police come back in, he starts to open up about what really happened.
And to your point, yeah, Maggie, I think, am I right that it was really like the day or two after the murder that a canvassing officer had first spoken to this man all those years ago?
I know. It's just the frustration you feel when you hear that, where you know they questioned the man who's actually guilty and nothing happened.
What was his connection to Angie? Did that come out?
Yeah, he was a neighbor.
That was it.
That was it. And when he talks about the crime, it's almost this just horrible, dispassionate crime where he says he was a neighbor and he was high and he wanted to rape her. And he went to her house. He said, claims he had no intention of murdering her, that things got out of hand, and that he wasn't even clear that she died until the next morning when he saw police on the street.
I mean, I don't know because I haven't taken a look at this, but, you know, it's crazy to me that somebody like that went from like zero to rape and murder, right?
Yeah.
Generally, these kinds of offenders, like there's some history there. He's got a criminal history already. He's already attacked different women and that kind of escalates to this. But from the reporting, it seems like that's not the case here, right?
Mm. That's what's so troubling as well, because I agree. It's almost terrifying in its simplicity.
Right.
When he says, I just wanted to do it, so I went and did it. It doesn't seem real. And I think, you know, a lot of it, he hangs on being out of it, of being high at the time, of being, you know, on undisclosed kind of drugs and alcohol and making this decision to go over to her apartment. Again, he claims he never meant for it to go as far as it did. And once that happened and once he realized what happened, years later, he ultimately left town and was able to avoid ever being really a suspect, avoid ever being convicted. And he went on to have a family and to live a life for many decades.
There was something I wanted to ask about what you said earlier, and you said something to the effect of, like, the police really thought they were doing the right thing, you know, like they were really wanting to solve this, except the thing that jumps out at me and makes me think, do we really believe that, is the fact that there was a woman named Destiny Osborne who was a witness at the trial, who basically was a witness for the state, and she identified, she said that she overheard Chris Tapp and Hobbs talking about the crime. She became a witness for the state. And then years later, she recanted that and said she was forced to, she lied. So I wonder, I mean, like, you know, if the police really thought they were doing the right thing, like why they threatened her. They said, either you give us this statement or we are going to arrest you for, like, I don't know, drug related charges or something.
I think it's a really good question. And you know, it's something that the police have had to be questioned on, and there's been investigations into how this was handled. There's no excuse. You know, the excuse of being under pressure is not a real excuse when, when it comes to the life and death of, you know, people on trial. And I think it's always interesting to look in hindsight at tactics that were used and the outcome that they had. And I think the biggest hope is that people actually learn from this and these tactics are not used again.
Yeah. Now, Maggie, we have two postscripts to this case, one happy, one sad. The happy one, Maggie, right, is that as a result of this case, we have wrongful conviction compensation legislation that's passed in Idaho, right?
Yeah, and this is really a testament to Chris. You know, once Chris ultimately was released, and then once, you know, the rightful killer was convicted and he was exonerated of all crimes, he was a free man with nothing holding him back. And, you know, he spoke about trying to live life to its fullest, of making up for lost time. He worked with the Innocence Project. He was an advocate for those who were wrongfully convicted. He, you know, helped spearhead legislation that helps those with compensation who were wrongfully convicted in the state of Idaho. And eventually that went more further across the country. So he made a real difference. You know, he even mentions how he got to go to NFL games and WWE matches, and he was really trying to live life. But think about it. I mean, he lost 20 years of his life to prison. Those are 20 big years, ages, you know, your 20s and your 30s, major decades of when you're finding yourself, building a career, making a family, and he missed all of that. So yes, he was a free man. Yes, he's helping others who were wrongfully convicted, or helped others who were wrongfully convicted, but you know, his life was marked forever by this crime and by being falsely convicted of this crime.
Right, and that's the second postscript, which is in addition to being haunted by this wrongful conviction, ultimately he loses his life, right?
Yeah, this is, you know, I always say this is just the ending to this podcast that no one wanted. And that's that after 2 decades of being in prison for a crime you don't commit, you finally get out, you're finally living your life, and then just a few short years later, your life's taken from you. And something that's, you know, ultimately been ruled a homicide, the case is still active. It was a fight that happened in Las Vegas, and he did not survive. And all of a sudden, his story was cut all too short. And it sort of brings us back to the very beginning, what we were talking about, of this idea how a crime has such a ripple effect. And this one crime obviously took Angie Dodge's life, but it also, you know, took years away from her mother, who gave up time with her grandkids to search for her daughter's killer. It took the life, really, of Chris Tapp, who spent 20 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit, and then whose life was taken from him just a few short years after getting out. And you just see how many people are affected by one crime.
It's incredibly tragic. I have a question about Chris's family. Do you know, did they remain involved? Were they supportive? We hear about Angie's mom. What about Chris's family?
We know that Chris's mom was also, you know, there for all the court cases. Her and Carol were both there for him, supporting him when he was released. They were definitely active, especially his mother, supporting him through this time.
Mm. Yeah. Maggie, I definitely recommend this to our listeners. And my big 2 take-homes from the podcast are this shows absolutely the importance of recording all custodial interrogations, and also, to the point you raised earlier, reforming the way that police do a lot of these interrogations. What, in your mind, are the biggest take-homes that you'd like to have listeners take from your podcast?
Both those you mentioned, I think, are so important. Just this idea of false confessions and realizing how all of us are actually quite vulnerable when it comes to the impact of crime. And I think sometimes you think you're almost above these things, that it couldn't happen to you, but you hear how it happened to someone like Chris Tapp and you realize, wow, no, this manipulation, if you want to call it that, or this confusion, or this, you know, drive to falsely confess could happen to anyone, including myself. And the other thing for me, which I just, it lingers with me still, you know, weeks after finalizing this podcast, is Carol Dodge. Mm-hmm. I mean, just her passion and determination and her ability to not quit, even in the face of being told no, the face of heartbreak, she just keeps going. And I think, you know, I'm a mom myself, and I kept thinking about what she was going through, and everything, all the pain she was feeling, she just channeled into action. Mm. And there's this amazing bite towards the end of the podcast when the real murderer is finally convicted and Carol chokes up. You hear this emotion and she just says, I can finally get back to living my life now. I can finally be with my grandchildren once again. And I'm going to like tear up even talking to you guys about it. I've heard this bite so many times and it still gets me emotional because it's just, you feel how raw it is for her even decades later. And I think we can all relate to that in a way and put ourselves in her position. You know, what would we do? And she was just incredible.
And I wonder that, Maggie, because you're asking, like, what would you do in her position? I mean, this is, as far as I can tell, a woman from small town Idaho. She probably grew up in a time when, you know, feminism, women's rights wasn't a huge focus. Like, what was it, or what do you think in her demeanor and character and personality that allowed her to fight so hard to prove that the wrong person was convicted for her daughter's murder?
It's a good question. In many ways, I mean, the simplest answer is love, right? Her love for her daughter kind of gave her superhuman powers and helped her rise above anything that was holding her back. It gave her this confidence and power to not quit, to not take no for an answer, to not be satisfied with, you know, what police were telling her, not to be satisfied with one conviction, this relentless pursuit of the truth and justice that really, I mean, she was gritty and hardworking and passionate and full of love and grief and channeled all of that into helping find the true murderer.
That was a 23-year fight for her, which is extraordinary to have just the fortitude to keep going. But I have a question. Do you think if she hadn't, do you think the police would ever have gotten to this conclusion by themselves?
It's a really good question. Listen, there were a lot of people that also had Chris's back. You know, he had a team of attorneys working for him. Chris, you know, said he was innocent, was working on appeals. The Innocence Project did get involved on his behalf. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the state did reopen or continued to work on the investigation and brought in sort of new detectives to work on this case, fresh faces. It's tough to know, right? It's tough to know in hindsight. But I will say, having an advocate like Carol Dodge does change the game. And having someone to be, for lack of a better phrase, that squeaky wheel that doesn't let people forget. Because unfortunately, you know, people have to move on. Other crimes happen. People are busy. People have other things they have to solve and do. And Carol just made sure they never forgot about her daughter.
Wow.
Maggie, my last question for you is, obviously, as I said in the intro, you primarily are a correspondent dealing with foreign affairs, international issues. Has this podcast whetted your appetite? Do you have any future plans, maybe even concrete ones, to cover another true crime case in the future?
Yes. ABC 2020, are you listening? Yes, I have lots of passion and love for it. Honestly, though, I mean, the team behind these podcasts are incredible. ABC has an amazing lineup of true crime podcasts. All of them I listen to and just, you know, I'm white knuckled, gripping everything in suspense. And so it was truly, truly an honor to work with such a talented team that just really knows how to dissect true crime and to bring out the heart of it. I would love to work on another one. Nothing concrete yet, but, you know, you'll be the first to know.
Thank you so much. And we'll have you back on to talk about whatever it is you work on next. But like I said, once you've entered the world of true crime podcasting, you shan't escape. So I'm sure we'll see you again.
Keep me here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listeners, the podcast is The Snare. Again, it is a 6-part podcast series from 2020 and ABC Audio. And so, Maggie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, Maggie.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.